This is Atenea Americana.
Atenea Americana.
Atenea Americana.
A window to the Latin universe.
Stanford. 90.1 FM.
Radio Atenea Americana.
This is
Atenea Americana.
Bilingual house of culture. On the air and online.
Radio
Atenea Americana.
Su casa de la cultura en la radio y online.
Para la radio 90.1 KCSU Stanford.
I am Isabel Jubes.
Isabel Jubes. Bienvenidos.
Atenea Americana.
Welcome. Bienvenidos.
From Stanford to the world. And today we're talking with Dr. José Fragoso. He has led for many years the Fragoso Lab at Stanford University, researching big fauna in the rainforest. But later, he had also been in the team of the California Academy of Science. Most of his research is about the state of the mammals in the rainforest and in the Amazon and the relationship with the environment. This is an important topic for conservation of the planet. Stay with us. Again in Atenea Americana, and today our guest is Professor José Fragoso, for he has the Fragoso Lab, but he also works for the California Academy of Science. He has been doing a lot of research during his life about fauna and about sustainability, and he's here to talk to us a little bit about it. Thank you for coming and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Isabel, for having me here, and it's always a pleasure to come and speak about my research and the work I do in the Amazon.
You are originally from Portugal?
Yes, I am. I was actually born in the Azores Islands. Mm-hmm. They're like these islands in the middle of the Atlantic, far from, you know, like 1,500 kilometers from the mainland. Mm-hmm. Grew up there as a little child and then moved to Canada, the United States, and finally Brazil. Moved around quite a lot.
Part of your research, although you've been doing a lot also in Central America, has been in the Amazon and in Brazil.
Correct, yes. Mm-hmm. I started my work originally in Central America, in Belize, a little bit in Mexico, but eventually moved to the Amazon and eventually to Brazil, because it was Portuguese-speaking and much easier for me. So.
And what is the difference in the stage about how well conservated is the jungle or the areas in Central America in comparison with the Amazon and South America?
Well, the Amazon and most of South America is doing much better than Central America in terms of maintaining forests and natural vegetation and maintaining animal populations. Part of that is because Central America is just much smaller. And then when you compare it to the Amazon, although a lot of forest has been cut, it's still mainly a forested landscape. Beautiful forest. You can fly 2 or 3 hours in a jet airplane across it and just see green and more green with occasional rivers. It's still a very beautiful forested place.
And what is the stage of the Amazon right now?
Generally, it's still mostly forested. Unfortunately, though, there are serious threats that it's facing. Probably the most critical one right now is the development of dams and for the generation of electrical power that's happening in a number of places. And also some of deforestation for large-scale, industrial-scale agriculture. Mm-hmm. Those two things are bringing new threats to the Amazon and to its forest, and as well as to its people, the indigenous people. Mm-hmm. An old problem that continues is mining. So small-scale mining is still a serious problem, but as well some industrial-scale mining that's occurring. Unfortunately, the Brazilian government feels a lot of pressure to develop the area and has been very quickly developing certain regions, both for the mining, the agriculture, and the power generation at the same time.
I was listening the other day about the need of a lot of water in areas like Sao Paulo or some areas more urbanized in Brazil. Is this also affecting the Amazon?
It is affecting the Amazon, but in a different way than what we expected. Mm-hmm. Some really interesting research by some Brazilian researchers, Nobre, are showing that the Amazon is actually producing some of the rain that falls in southern Brazil, in Sao Paulo, for mm-hmm. example, that's experiencing a horrible drought. But the rain that is going to fall in that area, some of it is produced in the Amazon, a big part of it. And so when you have the clear-cutting that's going on, that actually works against the production of rainfall for the big cities down in southern Brazil, like Rio, like Sao Paulo, and the agricultural heartland of the country. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in one way, the government, in some of the development plans and some of the agro-industry that's coming in, might be generating some of the problems that are occurring in southern Brazil with the drought. And then there is also drought occurring in the Amazon occasionally, but that's not to the same scale as southern Brazil.
This is a country that is has a lot of industry, exports a lot of food. I think they even do solar panels, which so it means that they have a lot of mining. All this logging and all this development are legal? They are controlled by the government?
It's a mix. So the large-scale development in terms of dams and generation of electricity, that's all legal. Mm-hmm. So that's all vetted by the government. It has impact statements, sometimes not so well done, but they are done. And that part of it is legal. The large-scale mining is also legal. It's very hard to open up a Gran Carajás type of iron ore mine and not have it be legal. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of small-scale mining, which is almost all illegal, and actually is one of the biggest threats for indigenous people. And there's also illegal clear-cutting and logging for smaller-scale agriculture. The government has worked very hard to bring those things under control, and they've done actually a very good job in the last decade or so of controlling this. But unfortunately, more effort, on-the-ground effort, needs to be made because it continues to be a problem. Mm-hmm. The small-scale logging and the mining, small-scale mining, which is small only in the sense that it's an individual or a few people doing it. But when you add up all those people, then it becomes a big problem.
And there also has been the proposition for years of a big oil pipeline between Venezuela and Argentina crossing all around, all the way to Brazil.
Yes.
That cannot be good.
No, all these very large-scale plans that, again, are all legal are never very good. You know, many of them, much of the Amazon consists of indigenous areas and parks, and that means that much of these grand plans that the government is proposing will have a major impact both on the protected areas, the parks, and also on the indigenous lands and indigenous peoples. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's surprising because in Brazil you've seen the degazetting of some parks, something that's never occurred before, to facilitate dam building, or even the continued moving of indigenous peoples out of their homelands in order to allow the dams to go up or the pipelines to go through. And these continue to be worrisome because in this day and age, you would have thought that governments would be more sensitive to these sorts of impacts on the environment, on indigenous peoples, mm-hmm. and on the potential rainfall of their big cities.
And today in Atenea Americana, a conversation about the state of the Amazon with Dr. Jose Fregosa, a biologist from the California Academy of Science and from Stanford Fregosa's lab that has dedicated his life to study the fauna and its conservation with great experience in the Amazon and in the rainforest. Stay with us. I suppose just that relative with other kind of human settlements, indigenous people are more respectful and less intrusive to the environment than others, big towns, villages, or cities made by other Brazilians.
I would say that overall they're very good for the Amazon as a general rule. Most indigenous people who continue practicing their culture has built-in rules generally that don't allow them to overexploit the land, even though sometimes they may want to or some of them may want to. In many ways, indigenous peoples are like us. There's great variation in the behavior of individuals, and some of them are inclined to be more destructive and some are less inclined. But overall, in the general society, there are rules, and usually rules in their religion that doesn't permit them or at least minimizes the impact they have, the negative impact they have on their environment.
Mm-hmm. And they are normally hunters and gatherers, fishers. They don't really cut trees to grow vegetables or...
They generally will open up small farms, usually about maybe 1 hectare in size or less, half a hectare, and in that they'll plant their crops in a sustainable fashion, things like manioc, bananas, pineapples, and then they'll also do some hunting. They'll hunt mostly for mammals, but they'll fish as well. They'll hunt for primates. And then the women will do some gathering. They eat, lots of different things. They'll gather caterpillars, for example, and eat caterpillars, and they'll eat ants, and they'll eat a variety of things. So this great variety of food that they collect sort of lessens their impact overall over the land, because they're not just eating one thing like beef, and so beef you have to have cows, and cows you have to have grass, and you have to have lots of it because you're only eating beef or you're mostly eating beef. So they spread out their impact that way.
Do they have any type of cattle, like sheep or...
Some will have cattle, some will have sheep, so this is something they've adopted. One difficult thing that they have is holding on to their land. It's very difficult for indigenous peoples to hold on to their land. There's always people trying to take it. It can be the people coming in to log, illegal logging. It can be the people coming in to illegally mine. It can be the government planning to build a dam. And so they're always losing their land. And so one of their great challenges is how to hold on to the land. And one thing they've adopted recently, some people... I think of Raposa Serra do Sol, which is an area I've been very involved with. Mm-hmm. They adopted the raising of cattle, which is very, very odd because they're not cattle people. But they did that because the non-indigenous people only recognize that the land is owned when there are cattle on it in this area. If there's cattle, it means the land is being used and therefore should not be invaded. And so they... put cattle on the land, and it worked. They don't have the invasion problems anymore. But they're not cattle people. It was a political strategy to hold their land. And others have adopted other techniques, but... and now they are eating cattle. The Shavanti people, for example, are really fascinating. They have some cattle as well. They followed the same logic, but they don't eat the cattle. They see the cattle as kind of a bank account. And they'll sell some of them when they need sugar or they need gasoline for their vehicles or something, but they themselves will not eat the meat. And in fact, that's kind of a fascinating thing about many indigenous people. They won't eat animals that they raise because those animals are seen as people or part of the family. If you raise an animal, you can't eat it because it's like you. Only animals that are out in the wild can you eat. And so many times people have seen the raising of animals as a solution for indigenous people when they're hungry or when they need to occupy, hold on to their land. And then they can never understand why they continue to be hungry and they won't eat the animals. It's a
they have a connection then with them. Do they eat like jaguars or any other animals? I suppose that even if they are in danger, they don't eat that many, or they spread around.
They eat many animals, even endangered ones. But these animals are rarely, if ever, endangered on their own land. So jaguars, I just worked in an area that's about 2 million hectares in size. Jaguars are very common there. Mm-hmm. In fact, they're so common that they're sometimes a problem for children. Mm-hmm. And in one area, they ended up killing 3 people. And so when the animals come too close to the villages, they tend to try and eliminate the more dangerous ones that could kill someone, like a jaguar. But at the same time, they won't go very far to go chase down a jaguar. If a jaguar leaves, they'll just let it go. So they have this sort of perspective that as long as the animals aren't causing harm directly, that they're going to leave them alone. And then all animals, depending on which people, have a soul and spirits. And so you have to also be very careful how you treat that animal. Because if you don't treat it too well, the spirit of that animal or the protector of that animal who lives in the forest can come after you. And so there, again, I mentioned rules. There are all these rules that you have to follow if you're going to go hunting, if you're going to go into the territory of some other animals. And so you've got to be attentive and aware. And this kind of serves the same function as some of our endangered species laws, our park protection laws. The difference is it's embedded in their religion.
And these are at the south of the Amazon, the ones that you've been in more contact with.
They're in the north in the Amazon, the south of the Amazon. They're kind of all over. I've been doing this for a long, long time.
Oh, so you've been having contact with different ones because I suppose like a part that gets into Venezuela, there are already like 3 or 4 distinctive type of tribe.
Yes.
Bet the Amazon, the part in Brazil is 20 times bigger or 100 times bigger. They may have many different type of tribes. They are all kind of similar in that way.
Yes, I think there's estimated to be at least 200 different types of people in the Amazon region, or in Brazil, sorry, in Brazil. And in the most of those will be in the Amazon. And so you talk about Venezuela. Well, one of the groups I work with are known as the Yanomami people, and they're right. They're also in Venezuela and in Brazil on the mountains that separate the Orinoco River drainage from the Amazon drainage, and those are fascinating people. And the Makushi people, who are also on the border. And so those are really kind of fascinating when you meet people on the border areas, because you get a view of how does a national society like Venezuela influence their Yanomami, and how do the Brazilian national society influence their Yanomami. And the Yanomami are the same people on both sides, but the cultures are very different of the national societies. And you see this reflected in some ways in the people as well. So I was saying to someone, when you meet a Yanomami that comes from Venezuela, you would know he's from Venezuela, just the way he walks and his haircut and the way he laughs. And when you meet one from Brazil, you will know that he's not a Venezuelan Yanomami.
This is Atenea Americana, and I am your host, Isabel Jubes. You may find this and all my shows at StanfordHispanicBroadcasting.org. This is a bilingual cultural show, bringing you a window to the Latin and Hispanic universe. Every week, for 2 hours, one in English and one in Spanish, from Stanford to the world. You can also be part of this, leaving me your comments, sharing your thoughts, and even more at StanfordHispanicBroadcasting.org. I invite you to be part of this.
And today we're talking with Dr. José Fragoso about the state of the Amazon.
Interesting. I, are they, I suppose they're also very protected by certain laws, environmental laws. Like in Venezuela, you cannot just go and visit the Yanomamis. You need tons of permits to prove that you're a scientist, that you are there for a real research, not just to say hello and take some pictures.
Yes, they're very, both governments in Venezuela, my wife is Venezuelan, and in Brazil, they both have very strict laws about visiting indigenous peoples, who can go, how long you can stay. Permits are always needed. The unfortunate thing is that a lot of the people who do go there do so illegally. And so they still, even though the laws are very good, and the people, the government cares very much and tries very hard to control this, agencies of the government that work with indigenous people are usually understaffed and underfinanced. Mm-hmm. So that means they really don't have enough people to control what actually goes on in the ground, who actually goes there. Sometimes I think, is this a strategy of the government to underfund and understaff the agency that's responsible for this? Mm-hmm. In Brazil, they've eliminated, in the old days, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, each indigenous area, almost each indigenous area, would have a government staff person in that area that served as the person who interacted between the national society and that indigenous group. And they lived on the land and they had a house. All of that has been done away in the last 3 years. And so indigenous people say, well, who's here to speak for us? Because sometimes we don't speak the language, or even when we do, we can't make ourselves understood. So even the little that was there is being cut back, in Brazil especially. And in Venezuela, there was always even less than in Brazil. Mm-hmm. And so people who know little of our society, or even if they know a lot, are the weakest members of our society, the most marginalized, mm-hmm. have lost in Brazil what little representation they had. And that seems to be continued to be weakened, that representation. Mm-hmm. Which is sort of a sad thing, because in meetings I've gone to recently, you always hear the indigenous people and the chiefs say, well, why did FUNAI, which is the Brazilian government indigenous agency, remove our agents? You know, they always ask that, because they're the ones that helped us get health care. They're the ones who helped us when we went to the city or when people were invading our lands. And now we have no one here to do this for us.
They tend to stay there because in a lot of places around the world, indigenous people just move to the city, or they don't, it's too tough for them to keep living in these areas because government and economic pressures, and they have been affected by regular Western disease or civilization diseases. So they tend up live in the places, but this is a community that is staying there and is preserving their culture?
You have it all. So you have people in Brazil and in Peru and in Ecuador and maybe even Venezuela, I think, that have no contact at all with outside societies. The Zoe, for example, just had recent contact. They live without even knowledge of us. You know, but then you have people who live in the big cities that are still indigenous people. You know, I met someone from São Paulo, the city of São Paulo. 18 million people live there. But then there's some indigenous people there. I met some recently in San Francisco who say they're still indigenous people, but they're from San Francisco. Right. So you have this wide range. So the ones who are from there, they generally want to stay there. They don't want to move. But they also, those that are interacting with our society, the Western society, they need health care. They have they want education, or they have education. They have schools. They often have roads. They may even have industries. They may have tourism. They may have some crops that they sell. And so they need to be able to maintain those things. And so what those people seek who have contact is a financial support or developmental support that allows them to maintain their economic endeavors. So they would like some, often in these remote areas, they might want some way to get their crops to market. They might want a teacher, and a teacher who speaks their language, who has some idea. And usually it's the government who pays for teachers everywhere. They might want ecotourism. They might want someone to provide them with some money to build a hotel or something like that.
And today we're talking with Dr. José Fragoso about the state of the Amazon. In your work, I see you have a lot of research between fauna, interaction with people, indigenous people and fauna, and fauna in general, finding new animals and researching the environment and how it affects the animals. But what kind of research are you doing right now with the California Science Academy, and what kind of things you do when you go down there?
Well, one of my favorite things to do is actually work with large animals, and I've done that a long time. And in the past, what I used to do was catch them. I would catch deer and peccaries and even tortoises, and we would place radio tracking equipment on them. And I used to have a little airplane that I piloted and flew over the rainforest. Mm-hmm. And I'd follow the animals around. And the work was always very fascinating. You know, doing that, I was able to discover some really amazing things mm-hmm. about some of the wildlife. One of the sad things about Amazonian wildlife and much of Latin American wildlife is we know so little about it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like white-tailed deer in North America or almost all the animals here where everything is known. And so we continue in Latin America to try to meet this challenge of learning more about our animals. It's still a major endeavor. The other thing I work a lot with is, why are tropical forests so diverse? Why are the trees communities and the animal communities so diverse? Why in Ecuador do you get 400 types of trees or more, 600 types of trees in 1 hectare? And in all of Europe, you don't have 600 tree types. Mm-hmm. Or in Canada, you have like maybe 100. I'm not exactly sure. And so why does that occur? And so a lot of my work is about how plants move around, how seeds move, why a plant grows in one area and not another area, how animals contribute to that, how that tapir, which is a large animal like related to horses and rhinos, mm-hmm. How they move seeds around in their stomach and how they move them to specific places, and how they introduce nutrients to the seeds by putting like horse dung, their dung, on in with the seeds, and that provides nutrients for the growing seedlings. Mm-hmm. And so I looked at that in the Amazon and how that affects what trees grow. And interesting enough, we found that when large animals are moving seeds around, they actually reduce diversity, because all the seeds of the fruits they last ate will grow together in one place. Mm-hmm. And so you'll get one type of tree growing there. But then the rodents come along, the squirrels and agoutis, and then they'll move those seeds from the feces mm-hmm. and then spread them out even further and bury them. And then a new forest is created in that way. And that's something we don't have in the north to the same degree, that all these things are so tightly connected to one another mm-hmm. and also dependent on one another to move things around. Mm-hmm. We find, you mentioned Rodolfo Dirzo and his mm-hmm. defaunation work, we find that when you remove some of the large animals from an area, the forest tends to become less diverse for some reason, and we're trying to discover the why of that. So animals and plants help to maintain one another and maintain that very high diversity that we see in Amazonia.
And today in Atenea Americana, a conversation about the state of the Amazon with Dr. Jose Fregosa, a biologist from the California Academy of Science and from Stanford Fregosa's lab that has dedicated his life to study the fauna and its conservation with great experience in the Amazon and in the rainforest. Stay with us.
For example, a jaguar growing out of the south of the Amazon forest, is it exactly the same? It can be married and have kids with one in the north of the Amazonian, or probably not with the ones in Central America. One of them start going extinct. Can we just try to spread them around, or they are completely different?
That's an interesting question. I think it would be hard because first, they'll speak a different language. So a jaguar from the Amazon is probably not going to speak the same language as a jaguar from Central America, even though we think they're all, you know, they should be able to understand one another. They can interbreed, and so if they do interbreed, then they will produce young. I think in some instances where animals have become extinct or extirpated is the word that's more correct, meaning they're missing here, but they're still far away somewhere. If you cannot get animals from close by to repopulate that area, then it's okay to bring them from far away. It just makes it more challenging for them to succeed, because imagine that I bring you from, or not you specifically, but I bring someone from Russia and to the United States to try and make a life, and I bring someone from England to the United States to try and make a life. Well, it's going to be much harder for the Russian because they don't speak the language here, even though both will probably succeed or may succeed. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, it does. So it's a kind of like a cultural adjustment for the animals in a way. Every now and then we hear about new species being discovered. As you say, there is so much in the Amazon that we don't know. I suppose there is always some little insect or some particular animal that gets also discovered. But it doesn't mean that they're just appearing, or they have been there from probably thousands of years, millions of years. It doesn't underestimate the efforts to help the animals not to go extinct.
Yes. So we really don't, we have mathematical ways that we calculate how many animals there should be. And we use these complicated mathematical ways to calculate that because we have so little real information from the ground. And so it's really hard to know on the ground how many animals or plants, species there are. And when we work in the Amazon, most of the Amazon is really isolated, very hard to get to. You know, one place I go to, it takes me 2 days by jet from San Francisco. Then I land at a place on the main Amazon River. I catch a small plane, and I travel for 3 hours in a Cessna. Then we land, and then I travel by boat on a river for maybe a day. And then I'm in my place where I'm going to work. Sometimes I travel by 2 or 3 days by boat to get to my place. So most of the Amazon is still really isolated. And when people go to collect species so we can know what species there are, they tend to always go to the same places in the Amazon because those are easy to get to. Mm-hmm. The hard to get to places people don't go to. So that's why we still don't really know really how many there are. And why we continue, you know, I mentioned I work now for the California Academy of Sciences, or I'm a research associate there. Well, that's what they do. And so I'm planning an expedition to one of the most remote places I know, and we're going to collect new species. And I know that we're going to find maybe even new species of monkeys, certain lots of new bird species, new rodent species, trees, there'll be lots of tree species, because the reality is, we still know very little about the species of the Amazon.
Well, I just wanted to highlight that the fact that there are still a lot of new animals to be discovered and a lot of animals that we are discovering every day, it doesn't mean that we don't have a global problem with defaunation and animals going extinct, because a lot of people think like, well, yeah, this or that animal are in danger, but after all, I just hear these so many new animals appearing. But these animals have been there all along. They just didn't appear. They have been evolving for millions of years. It just happened that we are putting the name right now, or we are studying them right now.
Exactly. Most of these species have been there a very, very long time. Some hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of years. And we're always finding new ones there. It always amazes me, my friends who do research in the Amazon and live in the Amazon. It's like, it's not a big deal for them to find new species. The problem sometimes is giving them new names.
What is the real role of the Academy of Science? They do have a lot of educational programs. They teach and show kids and general public about science and about the research. But they also have a big side of researchers that actually go to sites, that actually go to different places around the world and find animals and find species and do a different kind of scientific studies.
Yes, all of that is really important. As a researcher, I always feel very guilty sometimes that I get to do what I like, which is to do my research with the animals and the plants and hang out with indigenous peoples in the middle of nowhere. And then when I start to feel guilty, I realize, you know, all this can disappear and is disappearing really rapidly across much of our planet. And so you feel like you have to contribute. And in fact, that's a big part of what I do now. I write articles that are for the public. I produce materials, books and things that are meant for use by indigenous peoples, by local peoples. I produce guides, popular guides for them. I will write newspaper articles or make sure that my research gets known out in the newspapers, not because I want to be famous, but because it's important that the news gets out there. You know, it's really fascinating. I wrote a story about how different Christian religions affect indigenous peoples' religions and how that affects the diversity of animals and plants when they switch religions from theirs to the new one. And then we wrote a little story released by Stanford News. It was picked up by Fox News and by NBC, and all about how Christian religions are changing biodiversity. So as a researcher, you need to get out what you do so that you can hopefully improve things. And the only way you can do that is by getting just the regular average person to start thinking about why it is you're doing what you're doing. And if you're successful, then some things change. The other thing I do is I often meet with governments and their representatives to try and set new policies. I meet a lot with the Ministry of the Environment and the Minister of Indigenous Affairs in Brazil and Guyana, and then help them to do some of the thinking about what new regulations should be developed to ensure that these things don't disappear from our planet. That is hard to do because it means I can't speak the way I normally speak to other scientists. I have to alter my language. I have to alter how I say things. I have to be careful not to. Scientists tend to be very direct, and I have to learn not to be so direct. And then in Latin America, you have to, in Brazil, you say, dar um jeitinho, which means to sort of dance your way into something very softly. And so all these little techniques you have to learn, which is very hard for scientists because it's not how our nature generally is. But we must do it.
Yeah, in the name of education and preservation.
Yes.
Well, thank you for coming here and talking to us. And, we hope to have you soon with other very interesting topics.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
And this was Atenea Americana.
Atenea Americana.
Stanford, 90.1 FM.
Radio Atenea Americana.
A window to the Latin universe.
This is
Radio
Atenea Americana.
Bilingual House of Culture. On the air and online.
Su casa de la cultura en la radio y online.
Para la radio 90.1 KCSU Stanford.
I am Isabel Jubes.
Isabel Jubes. Vuelve pronto.
Atenea Americana.
From Stanford to the world.
Remember to come back soon.
Ciao.
See you later.